The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Your destination was not production and manufacturing, a BAM perspective. It is now. So hope you'll have some of your questions answered here, and maybe we'll generate a few new ones. How many of you are at Urbana for the first time? Virtually everybody. How many have been here once or more? Twice or more? Three times or more? Twice. You've been here twice before. Well, Wendy holds the record, maybe not for being here the most, but perhaps for being here the longest ago. And Wendy, why don't you come up? We'll just have you meet everybody. Wendy came here as a University of Toronto student in 1957. So this is actually a little test for Wendy to see what she remembers from 49 years ago.
Right. Well, we came all night on the train, and a little blurry-eyed the first day. I see some students kind of resting, and I remember that feeling. It was a life-changing moment for me, and just the understanding of world missions and the understanding of God's purposes on the earth. I'd been a believer since I was a child, But this just, I think, prepared me, even though I didn't go in the mission field in the traditional sense. We have been on the mission field in a number of ways, as well as, of course, considering business as our mission. So I'll let John tell you about that.
This emphasis, as you know, on business is new to the InterVarsity Urbana Conference, and I really applaud this. I think that for too long, these two worlds of missions and ministry and business have been separated from each other, and the reality is that most of us as believers are going to end up in some aspect of the workforce, and it's good that we would be taking a more holistic view of that. There's a strong emphasis in this conference on the importance of call and calling, and I can say for myself that I really ended up in manufacturing, production out of a sense of call. And when I got a hold of that, I realized it was just as powerful and just as compelling a call as a call to any other kind of ministry. And so for quite a few decades, I've been working with all my heart, as unto the Lord, but in a business setting. The workplace, at the very least, is a fertile ground to reach other people. We were going through our Christmas cards the other night and opened a card from somebody in our industry, a supplier who called on us, who I was able to lead to the Lord close to 30 years ago, and just to see that relationship being maintained. As business moves more globally, the reach that we can have as believers in the workplace also becomes more global. I met this morning before I boarded a flight in Cleveland with a young man who is part of our executive management team at our company in Elyria, Ohio, and he's home for 10 days from China. He moved to China in September with his wife. They're adopting a child, a Chinese child, and he'll be there for at least 18 months, maybe 24 months. But it was fascinating to hear his account of how he's getting enculturated into the Chinese system. He's actually opening a company for us over there. We're already in production in a temporary facility, and we're building our own facility on the south side of Beijing, and really firmly planting ourselves in that culture. And as we do that, our intent is to bring as much of the gospel of Jesus Christ as we can into a very different situation. Well, there are numerous dimensions, as you already would know, linking business and missions or ministry. And you've already heard reference to several of those. Microenterprise is maybe at one end of the spectrum, and one of our six children, a daughter, is on the board of a microenterprise organization, Enterprise Development, based in Washington, D.C., and we've gotten to know that work up close. And it's fascinating to see how principles of business are being taken into very small-scale marketplace activities and providing opportunities to reach people for the gospel. At the other end of that spectrum, earlier this year in Shanghai, I had the opportunity to visit a semiconductor company that employs 10,000 people in China. Its owner is a believer, and I was able to tour their factory and meet with some of their key people. In fact, they brought a group of 450 of their senior leadership together, and I was able to just share with them the gospel the same way that I would have the freedom to do that tonight. So this is a company right in Shanghai. They've just opened another operation in Beijing. They have started one church in Shanghai. Their condition with the government, who wanted them to go to Beijing, was that they would go as long as the owner said, "I'll go as long as you'll let me start two churches in Beijing." And the government is letting them do it. And the premise is, look, we're having visitors come from all over the world. We need a place where they can go and worship. And I visited a Christian bookstore that they'd opened. They have a community of place where people live, which is basically completely open to have Bible studies, to share fellowship, right house to house. And so business people at both ends of the spectrum are having a powerful impact in foreign countries. I'll just mention tent making. You would know that as a legitimate biblical way in which people have been able to combine business and ministry. We have a tent maker working in our company on the plant floor. He's an African-American pastor who was asked to relocate by the church that he's a part of, and he said, "I don't want to do that, even though we're not a wealthy church. We have our roots here. We're having an impact here." He said, "I'll go to work as long as I can stay in this church and pastor." And so he's actually turned out to be a wonderful emissary right within our factory. People call him Pastor Kevin, and he really is. There's another dimension, which I'll call covering activities. That's controversial, but this would be the concept of a business that's established in a foreign country, really as kind of a covering for carrying on missions activity. The reason it's controversial is that it can end up being a mix that gets very fuzzy. What are you really there for? And if there's any duplicity involved, that becomes transparent, including to government authorities, and it can be problematic. Certainly need to mention the significance of people who are called into conventional businesses, an accounting firm, a multinational company, a small business, but they're there to be salt and light. They're there to be ambassadors for Jesus Christ. And I see that as probably a model that is going to come closest to fitting most of us who enter the work world, because that's where the jobs are, that's where the people are, and yet the opportunities are also huge. We do business with a division of Emerson Electric, a very large company. And one of the divisions of that company, their motor division is headed up by a gentleman who actually became a believer through a relationship that we have with him and his family. And his division of Emerson Electric, representing about 15% of that company's sales, is the most sought-after division of the whole company to work for. And he's just walking out kingdom concepts and principles as a division manager in a very large company. So they're just all kinds of flavors. I would just finally mention the concept of what I would call the kingdom company. And that, I think, could almost apply to anything else that I've said. But the kingdom of God, when we really get our minds and our understanding around it, is pervasive. The kingdom is wherever people will allow the power of God and the Spirit of God to be manifested and flow through them. And so I would just maintain that it's possible to take the kingdom of God into virtually any legitimate circumstance or situation and represent Christ there. I think that really comes very close to the whole concept of the ambassador that we read about in 2 Corinthians 5. We are ambassadors for Christ. It goes on to say that we are workers together for Him, and that doesn't prescribe the boundaries in which we work. But I think that if it were possible to tap into all of these seminars that are going on in the plenary sessions and businesses mission, you would see this complex network of relationships and linkages fleshed out in just a marvelous way. And I think that behind that is the understanding that God is really in this thing of linking business and mission. We can speculate as to why this is so much on the Lord's heart. I'll just mention a few reasons. I think they're very obvious reasons, but the first is that that's where the people are. I mean, most people are in the workplace, and God's in the business of reaching people. And so He's going to go where folks are. And that's a reality today. Second reality is that there is influence possible through business that may not be possible through other avenues. You know, it's interesting when you look back over phases of history that various institutions have been dominant at different periods of time. The military was a dominant institution, say, before 500 BC, and then church or religious activity was dominant for maybe another 2,000 years or so, is the period during which major world religions were established. And say from 15 up to 1500 AD, the church was the dominant, or religious institutions were the dominant institutions in society. And then there was a period of time where the world was primarily influenced by nation states. These were empires that were built. Many different empires, but they were basically influencing the whole world. But somewhere in people who have tracked this more closely than I, say maybe around 1950 or so, so the recent phenomena, business and commerce really became the dominant influence worldwide. And you have multinational companies today whose revenue stream would exceed the GNP of countries in which they're doing business. Very, very large, very dominant influence. And then I think that an inescapable fourth observation I'd make is that God simply makes choice. And for whatever reason, He seems to be choosing business and commerce at this point in history. And I'd like to just point to a scripture that I read this morning. Maybe an affirmation to us of how God does choose in ways that influence our lives. And this is a dialogue that Moses had with God at the burning bush. So you're familiar with the story, I trust, but this is in Exodus chapter 3. And I'm just going to mention the action verbs that are reflected over four or five verses here, beginning at verse 7. And And the first thing the Lord says, I have surely seen, he's talking about the oppression of the Hebrew people, I've surely seen. So here's a God who's looking on and who sees. And then he says, I've heard their cries. So already in this visualization of God, we see his eyes at work and his ears at work. And then he says, I know their sorrows. Here's the compassion, the feeling of God. And that's all in one verse. And it goes on to say, and I've come down. In other words, he observed, he looked, he listened, he felt, and then he began to respond. He said, I have come down to bring them up. Bring them up, of course, out of Egypt into the promised land, but I have come down to bring them up. And then he says to Moses, I'm going to send you. Another action verb, right? I'm going to send you to bring them out. And then finally, and this is so reassuring to us when we couple this with the whole concept of being sent, I'm going to send you, but then he says, I will certainly be with you. I'm not going to send you and just let you go out on your own. We just came from a dinner tonight in which InterVarsity was citing some of the common characteristics of belief among college students today. And one of the comments was that God is generally viewed as passive. He's acknowledged typically as a creator, but he's also seen as being a passive God. And this is not a passive God that we're reading about here. This is a God who's active, engaged, and there for the journey, not just to set things in motion. So as we think about going into whatever missions calling God gives us, we just need to absolutely anchor into this reality that if he calls us, he'll be with us. He's not going to leave us out there on our own. Well, the topic tonight, production and manufacturing, is close to my heart, and I suspect you have an interest in that. That's why you're here. Basically, we're folks that make things, as opposed to shuffling paper and drawing up contracts and the other things that people do. We make things, and I don't know, do you like making things? I do. I like bringing things together and seeing something come out of it that goes out and provides a useful service or product for people. You don't have to make things to be in production and manufacturing. You can harvest things out of the earth or out of the sea and add value to them. And we collectively, we people who make things, employ an awful lot of people around the world. And there's concern, of course, that more of those kinds of jobs are leaving North America and going elsewhere, but there's still an awful lot of manufacturing here. And curiously enough, there are foreign manufacturers who have found that this is a pretty darn good place to make stuff in North America. And so you see Toyota with, 11 plants, and BMW with a number of plants, Chinese companies, what's the big Chinese company, Haier, the appliance manufacturer, they're coming here, they tried to buy Maytag. And so obviously it's partly to try to reach the North American market, but the reality is that you can do pretty well making stuff in North America. Well, I'd like to, it's Thursday night and kind of a good night to go to the movies, so we're just going to depart for a few minutes here, and I've got a little video clip that I'd like to show you, which is kind of the antithesis of production and manufacturing from a business, from a BAM perspective. This will be the baseline. This is what we should not be thinking about. You'll perhaps recognize the character in this movie when you see him. And we're going to hope this works. Okay. Crusading in the pursuit of happiness, that was another thing that came out of the discussion tonight that the typical college person, really, their goal in life is to be happy. Okay, so.
Attention, foreman.
Well, the boss looks at a piece of machinery that enables the employees to eat while they keep working, and that's a big flop. And before long, Charlie Chapman gets sucked into the gears of the machine and gets a very sequence. But I don't think they had much the idea of business's missions concept back then. And I think that, as maybe you've heard elsewhere, this really is a relatively recent emphasis. Business's missions can come in all colors and hues, as I've already mentioned. In regard to production itself, I contrast what we saw there with what we've learned about production in our own operation. We're doing everything with teams. We have people who are rotating through those teams on a daily basis. They're solving their own problems. They're fixing their own equipment. They're scheduling their own work. They're solving problems on the line when it happens, and we're doing it with a minimum of supervision. And people enjoy their work because they feel that they're really contributing and adding some value in a manufacturing setting. Well, it's very hard here in a seminar room in St. Louis to give you a feel for what's happening in a manufacturing company in Ohio, where we've tried to bring the concepts of the kingdom over several decades now. But we're going to attempt to do just that. This is another video, and I'll just tell you the story behind it. For many years, we were trying to integrate faith and work in a manufacturing company, doing it pretty obscurely in northern Ohio. And a major news network became aware of what we were doing and decided to do a story on us. We were reluctant at first to say yes because I'd had some unfortunate brushes with the media, but circumstances were such that we just said, well, go ahead and do the story. Well, in 1995, on World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, they aired a four-minute news piece that turned out to bring more positive response than anything they had run on the evening news. And that really got me in gear. I said, if there's that much interest in this subject, we'll do some writing on it. And Greg, that was the origin of the first book that came out a few years later called Loving Monday. And it basically told our story in greater depth. And that book, by the way, has gone into 14 languages, and two more are underway. It's just gone right around the world trying to encourage people that there's a way to bring these two worlds of faith and work together. Well, because of the visibility that we got through that, there was a lot of interest in people actually coming in and talking to us firsthand, seeing what we were doing in the company. And we were able to arrange to bring the ABC reporter back into the company, the same one who had done the story with Peter Jennings, now no longer with ABC News, but her name is Peggy Waymire, and she did this story. So I'm going to do this in two segments. The first segment is basically laying the groundwork for how we have tried to take a faith-based approach to our work. And I'm going to break it after 8 or 9 minutes, and then just set up the second part of it. Second part of it, I'm going to have a little exercise for you to get engaged in. So, Greg, if we could roll that. This is called Loving Monday Video.
In the mid-90s, television correspondent Peggy Waymire visited the R.W. Beckett Corporation in Elyria, Ohio, on a special assignment for ABC News. Her goal? To produce a story investigating how businessmen were integrating faith and business. John Beckett was an ideal subject for the story. A leading manufacturer of heating industry components, he had been successfully using biblical principles to run his company for years. Peggy's story aired on World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. Now, 7 years later, Peggy Waymire returns to the R.W. Beckett Corporation for a more in-depth interview with John Beckett about how his faith serves him and his company today.
Briefly tell me about the Beckett Corporation before you came on board.
Well, my dad started this business, Peggy, in the basement of our home. He'd been in the industry for about 12 years before that, but just got this vision to start his own company, and he launched into it right at the end of the Great Depression.
Initially, John didn't think he'd join his father's company, and after graduating from college, he worked in the aerospace industry for several years. Then, his father unexpectedly invited John to join him in business.
Before then, I knew him as my dad and my mentor, but now he was a business colleague. He helped me understand the industry and the product. He really required excellence in the work setting, but also at home. And so my two sisters and I had high performance standards to measure up to.
What are some of the struggles you've had over time with your business?
I was drawing deeply from my dad, and I had this picture of being able to work with him for 10 or 15 years. He, the mentor, me, the understudy. And when I got the news on a chilly Friday morning that he was found slumped over the steering wheel of the car on his way to work, it radically changed my world.
At the time, John had only been working with his father for about a year.
I was 26, and I realized that I had to make some very basic decisions about the future of the company. People called and said they were interested in buying it. Would that be a better decision? What about my mother, who was dependent upon the income that our business was producing?
Is that part of what led you to deepen your faith?
It was certainly a major component of that, but the particular year in which this happened, when my dad died, that wasn't all that was in store for me. We almost lost our second daughter. She fell out of a car driving up to our summer cottage in Canada, and really by a miracle, it was not killed.
Only 2 weeks later, a telephone call in the middle of the night brought more tragic news. The Beckett plant was on fire.
I got up here, and the plant was engulfed in flames. It was a volunteer fire department. They put out barn fires before, but they'd never been in an inferno like this, not knowing what chemicals, what explosives there might have been in the plant. And I just said, guys, we're going in. We battled that fire all night.
John considers the plant's survival a miracle.
We rallied our 12 or 14 employees together and actually did not miss a single shipment to our customers. I still don't know how we did that. But these successive hammer blows, my dad's death, the accident with our daughter, now the fire, all within months of each other, really brought me to the end of myself. And I started getting more serious about what I believed, who I believed in, than I ever had before.
Did you grow up as a Christian, or did you come to some point in your adult life where you chose faith?
As I was growing up, I attended a denominational church. I'm sure that I was exposed to a measure of the truth. I'm not sure how much it actually sank in. And after I met my wife, Wendy, I realized there was a dimension to Christianity that I really hadn't seen before. And that created a thirst, a hunger for me.
How did you come to a place where you decided to make God the center of your life?
There was a point where I just had to let go of myself and cast myself into the care of Almighty God. And in doing so, I accepted Jesus for who I was beginning to understand him to be, namely the Son of God, the person who had given his own life so that I could have eternal life.
What did you come to believe, and how did that change you as a man?
I think what I had experienced up to the point of real belief was an understanding of spiritual things at a certain level, but they weren't personal. What made it personal was an act of acceptance on my part.
how does it become personal?
It's the mystery of faith, and I don't know that I ever could fully explain it to somebody, but I know it's real because it happened to me when I engaged Jesus personally. I was able to look into his eyes by faith. I was able to hear his voice by faith. As I would read the scriptures, there were no longer black marks on white paper. They were words that were coming from the Lord, and they were personal, and they were relevant. They were alive. And I was encountering a real person, somebody who I realized loved me and cared for me.
As he began growing spiritually, John realized his faith and work life had little connection with one another.
I really began living in these two separate worlds. There was the Sunday world, and there was the rest of the week world. There was some problems at work again that brought me to the place where I just said, can there be a connection between these two worlds?
Okay. Two Beckett managers had been seriously quarreling on the job. To his amazement, John found insights from the scripture that he could apply in resolving the conflict.
It talked about conflict resolution. There was a passage I found in Matthew 18 that said, if you're having a struggle with another person, go to that person and talk to that person about it.
Let's talk a few things, for example.
The scriptures I found speak a lot about integrity. And integrity is critical in a business if you're going to have long-term strong relationships with your customers and your employees. They talked about finances, about honest weights and measures. How does that translate into how you keep expense accounts and how you prepare your financial statements?
And how you handle company resources.
What does stewardship mean to you as a CEO?
Stewardship means proper handling of what has been entrusted to me, entrusted by my Heavenly Father. Very often we associate stewardship with money and stewarding finances, and that's an important thing, but I really think it goes beyond that.
For example, the Beckett Corporation has developed advanced technology to conserve fuel.
The amount of fuel that our company has saved since we brought some new technology on the stream is enough to fill a train of tank cars that would go all the way around the world. It's over 2 trillion gallons of oil.
Kurt Oswald left a senior management position.
So we're just going to pause it at this point. What you've seen so far is really kind of laying the groundwork for how I became a believer in the first place and how I began trying to knit these two worlds together. And I just want to say in Wendy's presence that she was really a big part of my coming to faith in Jesus Christ. You know, it was interesting when I was in Boston and going to school there. I went to church, much to the amazement of my parents. But it was seeing the reality of the family that was walking in authentic Christianity that made all the difference to me. And Wendy purposely did not allow herself to give her heart into the relationship until she was confident that I really was earnest about my own faith walk, and I respect her for that. We wrote a lot of letters over about a 4-year period, and then after Wendy graduated from the University of Toronto, we were married and we began our family. But it was a long journey for me. Are any of you engineers? Look at the engineers in the room. You know what long heel marks you can leave across the stage of life. And that was certainly the case with me. It had to make sense. It had to be reasonable. I had to figure the whole thing out. And that was an impediment to that leap of faith. Well, the next segment that we're going to watch here is going to have very little to do with me and my story. It's going to be the story of people who have been impacted by the culture in the organization. And this is the little assignment I would have as we walk through this. If you can pick up specifics of how God's power and His presence have been working in a manufacturing company, we'll just have you play those back at the end of this segment, and we'll just take a few minutes to do that. So, Greg, we can look at part two.
One of Beckett's major customers to join the R.W. Beckett team. He's the company's director of its Advanced Technology Center. Kurt says one of the main things that attracted him to the Beckett Corporation was the company's atmosphere and morale.
The most incredible attribute of it is on New York's values and the kinds of people that work here. I mean, we're living in a time where there are a lot of things challenging American business. That doesn't occur here.
Kurt and many of the other employees we talked to credit John Beckett's management style and positive corporate environment.
I think any company starts with leadership, so it obviously comes from John's principles. And a lot of people would look at John's strong Christian beliefs and maybe almost feel uncomfortable, but he hasn't created it that way. I mean, it basically is about making a company a great place to work.
John doesn't preach to his employees or expect them to share his faith, but his unusual management style, which he calls servant leadership, is unmistakably Christian.
My concept of servanthood begins with the fact that I have an accountability to Jesus Christ as my master. That idea of serving Him infiltrates the thinking of all my relationships. So if I'm with a head of one of our departments or an employee on the plant floor, I'm thinking not how do I exercise any kind of mastership over that person or situation, but how do I serve them? What it does for every person is help them see if they're valued, and it gives them freedom to share their thoughts and share their heart in ways that they wouldn't if they felt that they were being confined in some way.
This philosophy trickles down into almost every corporate policy that touches employee lives. For example, the Beckett Corporation provides unusually generous maternity benefits. New mothers may take up to 26 weeks off after childbirth with partial pay if they plan to return to full-time work after that period. And there are other benefits Lisa Munko is taking advantage of.
They offer a program at work for mothers that want to work at home. They offer it up to 3 years. And I decided to do it for a couple months. I actually make these binders at home. I think it's important for me to be home with her right now.
The Beckett Company agrees.
And I can go back anytime I want. And they'll put me right back on the line that I left from.
Penny Seaman is R.W. Beckett's Director of Human Resources. She says the company's attitude toward employees begins with the hiring process, which includes extensive aptitude testing.
We really care about the people. We're not just so interested in what skills they're going to bring to us. We care about them as people. And during the process, we really want them to go away feeling very good. We want it to be a memorable experience. Regardless of the outcome, we want them to feel good about Beckett and want to even more so to be a part of us.
Beckett managers work hard to keep employees feeling good, even after years of service.
We have great longevity in our employees. 28 years, nearly 51 years.
Why do you think it is that some employees stay so long with the Beckett Corporation?
I think they see that not only the company cares about them, but their coworkers care about them. We have some awesome relationships amongst our employees. This place is fantastic.
Opal Sloan has worked at R.W. Beckett for more than 14 years. During that time, she lost her husband at 26 years. Only 2 months later, Opal's son was seriously injured in an industrial accident. Opal had to stay home to care for her son for an entire year.
He held my job, saved his benefits, and raised money. They sent flowers. They had prayer sessions for my son. Because I know in my heart that the prayer and the united being friends, family, something that pulled my son out of it.
Eventually, Opal returned to work, but continued caring for her son at home in the evening. At one point, the stress became overwhelming.
I thought it was having a heart attack, and they sent me to the hospital.
Mr. Beckman. I'm good at my job. I know what I'm doing. And I'm an asset to this company. I know I am. But he don't have to take time to come down. And he'll only be dead. And I'll never have a public speaking.
You know what, we may not have a cross-off run or even a steeple, but there's so much love in this building. There's been days I've walked in that back door with my heart down to my toes. There's always been somebody in this plant, from the office, even Mr. Beckham, all the way down, that has did nothing but support me and help me in every way.
In the same way that R.W. Beckett grew his son John into the family business, John is now training several of his own children for future leadership in the company. He and his wife of more than 40 years, Wendy, have a big family, 6 children and 8 grandchildren, many of whom live nearby in Elyria. Beckett's oldest son, Kevin, is now president of the company. Kevin sounds much like his father when he talks about the philosophy that drives the company.
I think it really goes back to our three core values: integrity, excellence, and profound respect for the individual. You know, integrity is a cornerstone, really, being consistent, being honest in all you do personally as well as in the business environment. Excellent. Again, you know, we're focusing on some tools that will help us become better at the processes that we now perform, the products that we design. And, of course, profound respect for the individual is essential as well, whether it's our employees, whether it's our customers, our suppliers. It's a concept of treating everyone for what they are. They're created in the image of God, and they are deserving of our respect in that regard.
To Beckett managers, that means helping employees grow to their greatest potential.
Part of the function of the corporation is to help identify what is really there in a person's genetic being that enables them to be all that they can be, to use an overused expression, but in a corporate setting.
Tim Brewster started on the assembly line, but was eager to move up in the company.
Basically, I was looking at doing some type of design work or something like that. Wanting to go back to school, but I wasn't sure how I'd actually be able to afford something like that.
Tim wanted to take a 2-year advanced program in drafting to prepare him for promotion, but it would have cost him $27,000 in tuition and fees. Then he heard about the Beckett Corporation's employee tuition program.
Through the tuition program, we'll pay for 3/4 of schooling, and so I know that ITT, they pay for 3/4 of tuition there, which allows you to be able to afford this one. After 2 years now, I'm almost done, and they're going to hire me on as being the drafter.
Tiffany Boyd works at R.W. Beckett, but also takes internet and home video college courses offered by Kent State University.
I want to end up being an OBGYN. I want to deliver babies. That is my goal.
Obviously, delivering babies has nothing to do with manufacturing oil burners.
It doesn't even have to be related to Beckett necessarily. So they're really interested in improving the people, not necessarily doing something to get something in return.
Why pay for college and give them all this extra training, which is pretty expensive?
It is, but I think it's cheap when you can develop employees within, employees that just know the organization, know our culture, know our people, know our values, and also have the technical understanding of our product line. It's really the best candidate to be promoted into a different area of the organization.
Joe Mohar is a perfect example.
I started here as an engineering co-op, and I moved into an industrial engineering position full-time. I went out to the shop floor for a year as a supervisor, and came back from our industrial engineering department, and I've been a plant superintendent for the last six or seven years. I don't think that they ever gave me a position that I hadn't worked towards. You have to set yourself up for success.
The Beckett Company's view of how to treat people extends not only to employees, but to customers as well.
I think we as a customer sense that camaraderie among the employees, that they feel a part of something and that they want to be part of something to make it right.
How would you say your philosophy of relating to customers is unique because of your faith?
If we take that idea of service, Peggy, and apply it to the customer, then we're coming in under the customer in a servant role. And our offering to the customer is not just put a product in the box and ship it, but provide a full support structure around what we do.
I think it has to do with the way we treat the customer when we interact with them. You know, we have big customers, we have small customers. Everyone deserves respect. Everyone deserves good service from us. And I think if we strive to do those things, it helps us maintain our market share. I think it's partly a posturing as well, one of humility. We think in terms of each day earning the right to serve our customers.
One snowy Christmas Eve, Jim Seaman, general sales manager for R.W. Beckett, received a call from a customer. The customer had miscalculated his inventory requirements for the holidays and needed additional products to meet his company's manufacturing schedule.
We had it here in stock, but we had no way to get it there. So I loaded it up in the car, and I remember there wasn't a lot of room in the car after it was loaded, but I drove it out there on Christmas Eve and delivered it.
It was a 3-hour round-trip drive in stormy weather.
I didn't think a lot about it, but obviously the customer came, they wrote a letter, and was young. She couldn't believe that somebody would do that, especially the day before Christmas.
I think one of the things that's outstanding about R.W. Beckett as a company is the fact that you can depend on that they are people of integrity.
John Beckett's reputation as an ethical and spiritual business leader has led many other corporate executives to inquire about his unique philosophy of business. Those inquiries eventually led John to write Loving Monday, a book already published in 10 languages. Loving Monday describes John's journey to blend faith and business. It's a journey John is quick to say has not completed.
What are some of the most important keys to keeping yourself on track spiritually?
Well, I've mentioned reading the Bible. Prayer is another absolutely key element. I can tell you that for 30 years, a small group I met, I met every Thursday morning to pray about our company, pray about our families, personal needs. It's a bond that is just very precious to all of us. We have a strong commitment to each other, to pray for one another, and especially pray for the companies that we serve.
If you could say one thing to CEOs for whom faith is important, why integrating faith into your business practice is worth the trouble, what would you want to tell them?
I would tell them, first of all, that it's good business. What customer doesn't want to be well served? What employee doesn't want to be in an environment where they're respected and valued? And I would tell them that life is more than just this month's bottom line, and that they want to get to a point in their lives where they can look back over their lives and say, this was a deeply rewarding experience. We can be worthwhile right where we are, right in the workplace. That can be our ministry.
Under John's leadership, the R.W. Beckett Corporation has grown from 12 employees and $1 million in sales to 3 businesses, 600 employees, approximately $100 million in sales.
Tell us what you attribute your personal and professional success to.
I think the Lord has been very gracious to me to not only equip me so that I can function in this arena, but to have the opportunity to do it. I think I've been successful in attracting good people around me, giving them the latitude to be themselves and to grow. We've experimented, we've made mistakes, we've been adventuresome, we've had fun. It's built a healthy enterprise that has prospered.
Thank you for joining us on this return visit to the R.W. Beckett Corporation. I hope you're encouraged, as I am, that one company's approach to bringing faith and work together continues to have a profound impact on every aspect of its business.
I had no idea when we started down this journey that this was going to have the impact that it has around the world. One little dimension of this is that this particular video in the hands of one of the divisions of Campus Crusade for Christ has been viewed by hundreds of millions of people around the world on public television. The year before last alone, 80 million people in India viewed this video. And so you say, how can you have a broad impact out of a manufacturing base? Well, the Lord has ways of opening these doors and in ways that we could never program or plan. What I'd like to do is just capture a few of the observations that you had, especially out of the second part of this, that will help us edify one another. And then I'm just going to have a few wrap-up comments and open it up for general questions. Some of the observations.
Boy, what grace was that introduced? I mean, not everybody comes off as that good. Your hands are those butters.
Peggy Waymire actually has become a good friend, and I don't know whether you've had experience being interviewed by a real pro, but I can tell you she drew stuff out of me that I didn't know was there. It's an amazing experience, and I wouldn't be too shy to walk through that experience if you have the opportunity, because it kind of plumbs the depths. Other observations? Particularly, I'm interested in what you saw of the evidence of God's hand at work. Yes? Now, the comment is the focus on people for who they are rather than people for what they bring in terms of skills or abilities. And you know, sometimes I'm asked what you look for in hiring people, and I will put those character qualities well ahead of skill level. Skills are important, but they can generally be taught. If the character qualities are not there in the first place, they're often pretty hard to build down the road. That's a good observation. We can teach skills.
I think your servant leadership style that theme here is a key.
The observation on the servant leader. And that term is getting maybe overused some. And I think we have to be careful of it, because the intent is not that it would become another technique, another tool in the toolbox, but it really comes out of an attitude of the heart that we're here to serve other people. And frankly, that's a key building block in making a successful organization. It's inverting the pyramid. Yes?
Well, you were visiting one of your co-workers, I was working with Penny. She was sick and her family was in a difficult situation, and that's probably more pricey for those who did not know those who were considered the bottom of the society. The question actually I have for you is, how do you scale that as your company grew from 12 people to 600 people, and you know, you have a lot more responsibility? Can you continue to do that?
There are a number. Why don't you tell me your names, by the way, when you make a comment or question, then I can address you more personally.
Oh, sure. My name is Lee.
Lee, I think that's one of the regrets that I've had with growth, because it's inevitable that you can't maintain that kind of personal contact with large numbers of people. The only way that I've found to sustain that aspect of the culture is to embed it as fully as we can throughout the leadership, so that it's a natural part of their contact with other employees to carry that same kind of an attitude. It's not perfect, but in a way it's also a great opportunity, because you're finding ways to multiply a philosophy through other people, and that's part of a legacy, I think. It's not just going off having done something yourself, but empowering an organization to do that. And there's a real reward in that. Well, Wendy's just recalling an incident that happened today on a cell phone call. I called back to my assistant, Pam, who's the young lady who walked into my office there. But she said, oh, Sheila's just telling us how her son worked through a very major surgery. So I said, oh, give me Sheila. And I talked to Sheila, who's been with us for over 20 years. Sheila has a story of her own, which I won't go into tonight. But her son, John, 20 years old, just had extremely major surgery and just able to, you know, connect over the phone and maintain that contact. So, yes.
I'm Bob Reds. You blew me away when I emailed you asking if you were interested, or knew anybody might be interested in financing this car project. I'm trying to start the sentence.
You're the gentleman. Okay, well, thanks.
Instead of emailing me back, you picked up the phone and told me, so I got a phone call from this guy who's left $100 million in difference in Ohio. His reply was, whatever you're going to do, do it to Dwight Nordstrom.
Who is here, by the way. So good to meet you. I recall reading your perspective and talking with you on the phone, and it's very, very good to meet. Well, got to meet this gentleman. He wants to build a car in China, and that's a large dream, so. Thank you.
I saw sort of God working through a lot of interesting details in building the company. And I'm curious to know,
what's your name? I'm sorry.
David, sorry.
David. David, this is a perplexing area for us right now. We have been sourcing in China for some time now. What's happening is that we're transitioning to our own manufacturing operation rather than an outside source. And part of the reason for that is that we really want to have more of an impact on the culture than we can through an independent contractor. Internally, what does it mean? That's a very sensitive area for us right now because we're in a business downturn that is related to the high cost of energy and warm weather, and there are various things that go in that mix. But we're slower right now than we've been for 20 years. And it's really challenging for us because while we don't have an inviolate policy of not laying people off, we've had a practice of not laying people off, which we have maintained for most of our corporate life. And it's crunch time for us because we're actually overstaffed by quite a few people right now. And we're actually praying and looking for creative ways to employ those people. We've been writing to other employers in our area and saying, can we subcontract some people to you? We actually called one of our competitors and asked if they would like us to make their product for them. I said, we'll do a good job making your product and we'll compete against it, but we can make it. So we're trying to think outside the box. But what makes it even a little bit more touchy for us is that at the same time we're doing this, we're building an operation in China. And I know it's created a certain amount of concern on our plant floor, but our approach is to just be totally upfront about what we're doing. And over-communicate. And basically, when it comes to these things, you're just depending on people trusting you to do the right thing. And we tell them that for the sake of our overall long-term business, we must be a competitively cost-based supplier. We can't compete in the world market and have premium costing. And so we're trying to protect jobs at home, believe it or not, by having a certain portion of those offshore. And it's that mix that I think is going to produce a healthy long-term situation. We're very committed to the people that we have on site. And really it puts a responsibility back on management to find ways to keep adding value to people stateside, because there are certain things that we can never replicate offshore. That's why the emphasis on education, that's why the emphasis on investing heavily in equipment and machinery and so forth, so that we are really a high value-added supplier in our domestic market. It's a great question, though, and it's a sensitive area right now.
Kevin?
Yeah.
A question more personal. When your business started growing, how did you manage the time with your kids, with the family relationship with your son?
To hear the question, great question about the tension between work and family as the business is growing. Do you like to answer? Let Wendy give you an insight, because, well, she carried a lot of this load, but I think she might have a thought on that.
John had a wonderful ability to come home and leave work behind and just get down on the floor and tussle with the kids at night and around the dinner table to draw out of them, you know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? So that, you know, they were with us, even at a fairly young age, beginning to understand some of the issues that John was facing. But he put family first. He put the Lord first, and then family second, and the company third. And the Lord honored that, obviously, as you can see.
And there's a lot of grace of God involved in that whole scenario, too, because this is probably the number one tension with successful business people. I'm part of a forum of business leaders. There are approximately 150 of us in a fairly low-key group, but the combined employment of those 150 business leaders is close to 6 million employees. It's very, very big companies. And we talk about issues. We talk about life. And this is the number one issue. It's that trade-off. And the demands in especially large public companies today are so intense that there's often a real trade-off at home. And that's a tragedy. I think that obviously there are seasons when we have to be away and just depend heavily on our spouses and others. But over the long run, it must not be habit forming, because there's just too big a price to pay for that. And one of the things that I can say looking back now, and our children range from 31 to 45, they're all walking with the Lord. They've married into great relationships. We're now up to 11 grandchildren, and our grandchildren are walking with the Lord. And it's payback time, you know. What we've sown into them is just being so richly rewarded. I'm working with two sons and a son-in-law, and I just can't tell you. I mean, talk about what constitutes success. And I put that sort of privilege well ahead of any kind of monetary success. This is a picture of our current extended family I carried around in my Bible, because I'm not always home either. And it's just a wonderful reaffirmation that God's interested in family and relationships. Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, I've toured some companies, and you know, I expect the tour to include, you know, changing my view of manufacturing, how it's set up, and in that aspect, and obviously change my perspective of what my job is entitled. But you know, to actually have people tour your company and have their lives changed is, I think, the next step. You know, inviting people in your company and through my company, they don't really know what they're going to expect. All of a sudden, it's this, and you know, living Christianity on the floor and in the structure, I think, definitely a mission.
Well, you know, we can end up working with people for 20, 25 years, and 40, 50 hours a week. And if you're not authentic over that kind of exposure, then you're not going to have an impact. impact. So I know we have many, many people in our organization that aren't churchgoers. They're not involved in any other kind of fellowship. But they're watching. They're watching me. They're watching Kevin, my son. They're watching other managers. And what often happens, it's happened time and time again, they come into some kind of a crisis situation in their life, and then they want to talk. And it's got to be available. But that's often the point at which somebody has come into a vital relationship with Christ. But they've been watching for years. Kevin in the back.
Yeah, when you told the general public, the thing that gives the most negative impact on this is executives, is the whole question of executive compensation, and especially things like executive union bonuses, I don't know if you have a company policy. I'd be more interested, actually, in knowing what your policy is in grants, GE or something. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was just at a seminar for directors in New York City, and I heard a statistic that stunned me. In the 1970s, the ratio between the CEO salary and the person on the plant floor was 30 to 1. Do you know what it is today? 369 to 1. Think about that. And I think that really is a problem. I'm on the board of a public company. It's a $2.5 billion company, and so I see on the inside, I had the compensation committee, so I was dealing with the consultants who were bringing all this data to say where these CEOs and top leaders should be paid. And frankly, I think that we've created a great problem for ourselves in this, and I'm all for people being paid well, I think we've long ago crossed a line of what's proper and appropriate. And the problem, and we've been seeing major company CEOs march off to jail after being indicted, and it isn't enough to have a couple $1 million a year. I mean, here was the head of the New York Stock Exchange, who I've met personally, pulling down $60 million. I mean, is there any kind of a public trust involved in that? Well, you look at who was making those calls on the compensation committee of the big board, and these were the heads of very, very large companies who themselves were pulling down these mega salaries, and so it was like a club. No easy answers to it, but I think compensation is becoming a critical issue. Yes. Sorry, your name is?
Ann.
Where are you from, Ann?
South Dakota.
University of?
I go to University of Minnesota.
University of Minnesota. Well, good to have you here.
I'd be interested to know what your opinion is, or how you think of how unions play a part in manufacturing and production, and why you think we've seen a lot of a big decline in unions over the last couple of years, and kind of what your observations are.
It's a big topic. All of our plants are non-union, and we work hard at maintaining non-union status. And the main reason for it, I'm not philosophically coming down one side or the other on this, but the main reason that I feel it's important in what we're trying to do is that I don't want a third party between me and the other people in the organization. I don't want to have to go through somebody to communicate directly with our people. So that's a specific answer in our situation. As to the general answer, I think unions are in decline because organizations are doing the things that gave the union movement traction a number of years ago, and they're doing it voluntarily. You look at the automotive companies, Toyota, Honda, and others, they're essentially all non-union. But the wages are comparable, the benefits are comparable, and in some ways the work environment is actually superior to what it is in the unionized companies. So I think they're having a struggle for relevance, and I don't know. Every individual situation has to be looked at, but that's a trend that is unmistakable. I think we're 8.5% of the manufacturing workforce now are unionized, and in the late 70s it was 15%. Well, that's like cut in half, and close to it. So it's a big decline. We're going to wrap up. I want to just explain the two things that were handed out to you. You're welcome to take those with you. The one that's called a corporate roadmap is our effort to just state in one simple document the things that are most important in terms of company culture. We spell out our vision, our mission, our values, and then some guiding principles and philosophy. A lot of care goes into developing something like this, and we use it as a vehicle to communicate and sustain our cultural imperatives through the organization. So you're welcome to take that. It may have some usefulness to you now or in the future. The other is a little booklet called Coming Home. Just very briefly, I began writing this the morning that the Columbia Space Shuttle broke up. I was in the space program at one time and kept a close interest in that. And what gripped me is I saw those six U.S. and one Israeli astronauts facing eternity was, did they know the Lord? And so I started doing something that I wanted to do for some time. It took a trigger event to do it. And that was to put into just as clear and simple language as I could the heart of the gospel message. And along with the short personal testimony, that's what that booklet represents. Now, I just want to give you a quick update on this because a miracle is happening in our midst. And the miracle is that that vehicle that you're also familiar with, the internet, the contents of this went up on a website. If you'd like to write this down, it's called lifesgreatestquestion.com. Lifesgreatestquestion.com, no punctuation. And I want to tell you the miracle that's happening on this website. It went up in February, and we began buying some ads on Google to try to steer people to this website. In 2 weeks, we'd heard from people in 172 countries. And we have a mechanism on the website for people to respond if they want to accept Christ over the internet. And almost from the get-go, one out of eight people indicated a decision for Christ. So we started putting more money into advertising. And the more money that we put in, the more people responded. And yet this percentage of one out of eight has tracked absolutely within a fraction of a percentage from when we started. And last month, the last month for which we had data, there were 18,000 people who visited this website, and over 2,000 of them committed their lives to Christ. And I can tell you that we're short way from January 1. We're going to double again our investment into advertising. And I believe that if the pattern holds, we will double the response rate of people committing their lives to Christ on the internet. This is basically the message that's up there on the internet. Most recently, I've completed a 30-day study to help these new believers get established. It's almost like a kind of triage for getting them roots going down in the faith. And I cite this not only because it might have a direct application for some of you, but I just want to send the message that a person out of a business environment can have an influence in the lives of tens or hundreds of thousands of people for the gospel right out of a business environment if they're sensitive to where the Lord's working and how He's leading. So whether it's this video that's been viewed by 80 million people in China, or now this website where thousands each month are indicating decisions for Christ, and I don't know where it's all going to go, but I'm just breathless at the magnitude of what God is doing through people in the business community. And so your interest in all of this is not ill-founded. My closing advice is see where God's working and just follow Him in it. And you can be every bit as much an influence, maybe even more, if it's your calling in a business environment, than you can in any kind of made-up thing because it sounds spiritual. I went through all of that. I thought I was supposed to be a minister if I was going to make a difference. And it's not where my calling was. It was right there in the workplace. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause.